with the Almighty Allah. It was this holy month in which, you know, we gained so many different things, and we lost and we got rid of the burden of so many sins. And it is this kind of a friend or entity or essence or being, the holy month of Ramadan, that we are going to miss when it is all over a little too soon.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about how we need to make haste before this invitation is over all too soon. So, of course, we're talking about, making haste. So what are we saying? Well, you know, these few days, handful of days, really, that we have left of the holy month of Ramadan, you know, even if that amounts to being two solid weeks that are left in the holy month of Ramadan, but we need to take advantage of these 2 weeks. Of course, the things that are, you know, recommended, such as asking for forgiveness, is something that we need to be actively doing in this holy month of Ramadan, that which is left, at least, of the holy month of Ramadan. You know, most probably, we have these beautiful nights of Qadr coming up, and we'll talk about, you know, what we should do in those nights in another program. Of course, we have this idea of improving our relations with our friends, with our family members, with our spouses, with our children, with our parents, things that we haven't even started to talk about yet in our programs. Of course, this idea of establishing a connection with the Almighty Allah, who has invited us to this banquet, and many of the other different things, you know, focusing on our prayers, really overcoming our base carnal desires and our base feelings that we have, you know, that prevent us from being able to live that Islamic lifestyle. And of course, things along this nature. We really need to pay attention to these things in this holy month of Ramadan, you know, and really take this opportunity that we have been given by the Almighty Allah to be able to live and refresh our Islamic lifestyle, and make haste, because surely, you know, this holy month of Ramadan is over all too soon. And then we are going to be wishing that this was the first of the holy month of Ramadan all over again. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
You lift me up high, you spread my wings and fly me to the sky. So alive, it's like my soul thrives in your light. But how I wish you'd be here with me all year around. Ramadan, 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 ya
Congratulations to all at the arrival of a spring and revival of nature.
We'll be right back. Welcome to Israel Watch. On this episode, we will monitor the Doha negotiations' move to conclude a captives exchange deal while they're opposing ideas in the regime regarding this issue. We will also go over Netanyahu's criticism of the West's position after the German Chancellor's visit to Tel Aviv and the refusal of the tribes in Gaza to the United Nations' request to distribute aid. We'll also touch upon the internal Zionist disputes. Regarding these topics, I welcome Professor Hadi Kobayesi, Director of the Al-Ittihad Research and Development Center. My warm welcome, dear Professor. The United States is more enthusiastic about the truce and the captives exchange deal because it will also withdraw on the Yemeni front, which is what Biden needs in the heat of the presidential elections he is running. Professor Hadi Kobayesi, what do you think of the articles of the negotiations in Doha, Qatar, and what the Hebrew media mentioned about the American goals of this truce and the exchange deal? That is, calm on the Gaza and Yemen fronts, as Biden needs it in the upcoming presidential elections.
We prefer to deal with American and Israeli statements with great caution, based on the experience of the past 5 months. It is clear that there is great manipulation in the distribution of roles, and there are varying and contradictory statements from official spokesmen and media professionals. I mean, a few days ago, there was talk about the Security Council session. The American presented a paper for an immediate and permanent ceasefire. The session took place a few days ago. What happened to the discussion? The discussion was limited only to Yemen and the condemnation of what Yemen is doing. Yesterday, there was a call between Biden and Netanyahu. Netanyahu said that in the call, I talked about the continuation of the war, entering Rafah, achieving goals, and eliminating Hamas. There was no American statement explaining what happened in this call. Yes, we have a distribution of roles between two parties, and we must be careful in evaluating each movement. We are approaching the elections in the U.S., and therefore the Americans need an image, calm, but at the same time, the American image must have two components, an Israeli victory and an image of some peace, normalization, humanitarian aid, and truce. Biden cannot have the absence of unity in these two forms because he needs AIPAC, he needs the support of the Israeli lobby, and he needs the votes of Muslims. And he's trying to get this needle out of this haystack. He's trying to support the Israelis to an extent, and at the same time, humanitarian aids. If we notice this last month, for example, under the roof of this slogan, under the policy that the U.S. follows, with all the aid that intervened, Israel committed massacres, about 50 massacres, and the Americans didn't talk about it. Biden did not comment. He did not comment. I mean, he sends aid by air or by sea while there are daily massacres, but he does not have a permit, and therefore there is such a coordination between him and the Israelis. It means he sends aid, but the Israelis prevent them. Biden would say, I did what I had to do for my American voters, but I did not do anything that would embarrass the Israelis in front of the Jewish voters or in front of the Israeli lobby.
Let us turn to Smotrich, who strongly opposes any captives exchange deal with Hamas and sees this as a threat to the captives. The attack on Rafah will be scheduled after knowing the outcome of the negotiations in Doha, and as soon as the occupation army begins transporting the displaced Palestinians from there, the enemy will begin the opposite of this attack. Professor Hadi Kobayesi, Israel links the attack on Rafah to the fate of the Doha negotiations and Smotrich's position of basically refusing to negotiate with Hamas.
Smotrich and Ben-Gvir do not have a change in position or a political process in thinking. One position from the first road to the last road, regardless of the results, the effects, the repercussions of relations with the Americans, and the situation on the ground.
Even Ben-Gvir called for the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh instead of going to the Doha negotiations.
The movement is disconnected from political reality. It has goals that it sets, and by following them, it comes to the results and the possibility of achieving the goals, their outcomes, and their repercussions. What about Rafah? But this movement is being used by Netanyahu to say that I have a movement that I don't know what I want to do with it. and I have to sponsor it in front of the Americans, in front of the liberals, Gantz and others, and also in front of the Palestinian negotiator, because they use this scarecrow. As for Rafah, we will see the negotiations, and I believe that according to the scenario I mentioned at the beginning, the war is continuing. And when Biden spoke, when he attacked Netanyahu with the same speech, he said two things. We will not stop the weapons, and we will not stop the war. We will not stop supplying weapons to Israel, and we will not accept stopping the war. These are frank words from him. I think this scenario is the one that works.
Let us move on to the visit of the German Chancellor to Tel Aviv, which was less sympathetic to the regime than his first visits, as he affirmed his rejection of military action in Rafah, which would lead to the starvation of the people of Gaza. After the visit of the German Chancellor and his stances, Netanyahu began to harshly criticize Western leaders because of their positions that are against starving the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
Netanyahu's statements were the subject of interaction on Israeli social media sites, and these are some of the comments.
Nedav Monk.
That is, they all say that security is stable.
Uri.
Netanyahu has been removed from our lives. You have destroyed everything. There is no security in the streets.
Ina.
The people here are also pushing for elections. The polls speak for themselves.
Donna.
Is there anything that Netanyahu did not succeed in destroying? Now also the relations with the United States? Enough has exhausted us. Leave.
Ilana.
You continue the war and do not return the kidnapped people in order to remain in power.
Fernanda.
They all want you to leave. Enough. You have destroyed Israel. You have brought the greatest disaster on it. Leave.
So, Professor Hadi Kubaisi, how do you explain this sharp criticism by Netanyahu of Western leaders after the positions of the German Chancellor, which were less sympathetic to the regime than his first visit, as the Hebrew media noted?
In the West, it works on several layers and several levels. One of the levels of work and courses of action is to prepare and invest in the results of the war. It comes as a savior, as an assistant, as a mediator, as a manager of a peace process and a negotiation process, and to avoid all the negative effects of the war that have been a repercussion. Demonstrations in the West, security crises, expected future crises, political differences even within parties. The West, for example, France and Germany, is one of these players who was initially supportive and sent arms to Israel. They all arm Israel from behind the curtains. But on the surface, they say, we hear the people of Gaza starving, we're helping them. So that the Palestinians took to the West as a party that has credibility and legitimacy and has pure, good, positive and humanitarian intentions, and therefore preferable to Gaza. This is according to Western thought. They say that the Palestinians sees that we come to Gaza, carry out a peace process, carry out a security movement, communicate with the tribes, communicate with the notables, and carry out political and field intervention within the Gaza Strip, so that we can achieve the goals of the war that Israel started, which is to change and modify the social and political situation inside the Gaza Strip. This path is progressing, even if the war will not end, but they have begun to prepare the image, language, discourse, positioning, and behavior to play this role inside Palestine.
In short, why does Netanyahu criticize them in this way?
It was a response to the American talk of the elections. The Americans have a collection of interests. It has a personal conflict, meaning there are personal interests between Netanyahu and Biden. Biden wants to go to the second term of presidency, and Netanyahu wants to remain in power. The problem is personal. Under the general policies of the two countries, the course of the war was underway and the whole world was happy. The basis is that we achieve the goals, eliminate the extremists, go to peace, and establish normalization. The Americans emerge as a peacemaker and thus left the Jews and Muslims and their reconciliation among themselves, and he wins at home. What happened is the delay in achieving the goals, and it has become a problem. Achieving the goals has not yet happened, and the time is running out because the American elections are getting close, and thus the Americans are taking action. They want to hold Israel, which has failed to achieve the goals, including Netanyahu. Netanyahu is the one who bears responsibility for the lack of electoral votes for Biden, and Biden holds him responsible.
Let us remain with the United States, as it's in a desperate situation. No one gives it any weight, not in the regime, not even in Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran. One of the most important achievements of Commander Yahya Sinwar is that he succeeded in creating a rift between the Israeli regime and the United States. Professor Hadi Qubaisi, what do you think of the words of this Zionist analyst who describes leader Sinwar as a wonder who succeeded in creating a rift between the regime and the U.S., which seemed to be in a situation where no one gave it any weight, according to Af Aitiam, the former Zionist minister?
Of course, there is a little bit of exaggeration in his words, or a provocation for the Americans who changed the way they deal with the Israelis. He even goes beyond the electoral issue and deals with it as an issue for the regime. I mean, if it was an issue related to the regime of Israel only, I believe that they would not have any problem. If Biden only takes into account the American strategic political considerations and its interests in the region, he will clearly go with them in the war. But as a result of the elections issue, they're demanding the U.S. go beyond the elections and treat them as a state. One of Netanyahu's main advisors is the one who incited him to carry out the ground operation and continue the war. And his words are clear. He portrays the Americans, as well as Abramovich, as people who are against Israel and are putting pressure on Israel and are silent about it, while the other parties are waging a war against Yemen. They're waging a war as well, and they have carried out strikes in Iraq and Syria and are arming the Israelis day and night. But they, the Israelis, are saying, "You are our enemies. You're fighting us in time. We must be friends." This is Jewish talk. Jewish grievance is their adopted method, exaggerating grievances in an illogical and unrealistic way.
I mean, Professor Qubaisi, Mohammed Dahlan's plan is clear as if it is an Israeli-American plan par excellence. What is the purpose of publishing such plans at this time in the Hebrew media? And basically, do you think they are correct?
It may be realistic, but it is a dreamy initiative. I mean, if the war goals raised by Netanyahu were achieved in the event of eliminating Hamas, there would be a possibility. But we should refer to the analyses, and not only the analyses. What does the annual threats report of the American Intelligence Council say? It says that in the coming years, the Israeli forces will try and struggle to dismantle Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And Hamas has proved that it will rebuild its strength and pose a threat to the Israelis outside the Gaza Strip during the next 5 or 6 years. We're completely far from this proposal, meaning the reality on the ground. I cite the American statement, or the official American analysis, which is an official document of the state, to say that they also acknowledge and admit to the media that they want to deal with this reality. But the reality on the ground indicates, and the events inside the Gaza Strip show, that this issue is very unrealistic.
Professor Hadi Qubaisi, what is your explanation for this insistence by the United Nations and the West on giving a role to the tribes in the issue of aid distribution without coordination with the Hamas movement?
They are establishing the political alternative. The land, society, and social infrastructure become separated from Hamas, and therefore Hamas has no role. Little by little, this land is demanding the authority of the technocrats, and we will reach it little by little, gradually. This is part of the course of the years that they are talking about, and in fact, Gantz talked about it at the beginning of the war or the first month. He said, "We need 10 years. This is a path that requires cultural, social, and security adjustment, and an adjustment in the balance of power at the level of the social structure."
The tribes rejected this proposal.
Here, his explanation for the tribes' refusal is that they are afraid that Hamas will not be eliminated, and thus Hamas will rebound and react to it. But the reality is that these tribes are Hamas, and there is no difference between them.
Director of the Al-Ittihad Research and Development Center, Hadi Qubaisi, thank you very much, and thank you for your good follow-up. Greetings until we meet again. God bless you.
in the limelight.
Trinity College in the UK has invested millions of dollars in companies involved in the Zionist regime's war on Gaza and businesses that benefit from the occupation of Palestine. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, scores of students held a protest outside the University of Cambridge's wealthiest college recently to demand the higher seat of learning divest millions of dollars from companies arming, supporting, and profiting from the Zionist regime's war on Gaza. Demonstrators carried signs reading, cease fire now, and divest from genocide outside Trinity College following a story published by Middle East Eye last month, which found that the college had invested £61,735 in the Zionist regime's largest arms company, Elbit Systems. Based in the city of Haifa, Elbit produces at least 85% of the drones and land-based equipment used by the Zionist regime's army. The company's weapons have reportedly been used in Gaza since October 7th and are also reported to have been used in the occupied West Bank and southern Lebanon. Middle East Eye also revealed that Trinity has investments worth approximately $3.2 million in Caterpillar, a U.S.-based heavy equipment company that has long been the target of boycott campaigns for its sale of bulldozers to the Zionist regime's army. At least one of the banners held up at the recent protest explicitly referenced Elbit and Caterpillar's roles in the occupation of Palestine. As the world-leading educational institution, Trinity must not be investing in companies causing so much death and destruction that may amount to genocide, and instead should be supporting the college's mission of advancing education and research, the protesters said in an open letter. Pressure has been mounting on the Trinity College to divest from companies complicit in the Zionist regime's war on Gaza after the UK-based International Centre of Justice for Palestinians, ICJP, issued a legal notice to the institution warning that officers, directors, and shareholders at the college may be individually criminally liable if they maintain their investments in arms companies that are potentially complicit in Israeli war crimes and crimes against humanity. On March 9th, an activist from Palestine Action spray-painted, then slashed a 1914 painting of Lord Balfour at Trinity. The incident, which was condemned by Britain's Deputy Prime Minister Oliver Dowen, is now under police investigation. To date, more than 31,000 Palestinians have been killed and at least 71,000 wounded in the Zionist regime's war on Gaza. The UN announced earlier this month that 80% of Gaza is now uninhabitable, while the hunger rate stands at 100%. The UN and several aid agencies have repeatedly warned that Gaza is on the brink of famine and have pressed the Zionist regime to allow aid in. At least 25 people have died from malnutrition and dehydration since the start of the war, including a 10-year-old child with the cerebral palsy. Last month, the UK joined Jordan, Egypt, the UAE, the US, Germany, and France in coordinating aid drops with the Zionist regime in different areas of the blockaded Gaza Strip. However, the besieged Palestinians have said that airdropped aid quantities are too small to deal with the needs of a starving population in the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, Crescent International wrote, as the low-intensity regional war and transformation take shape in West Asia, the fronts against apartheid Israel and its Western enablers are acquiring a multidimensional character. One of those multidimensional characteristics involves a grassroots economic boycott by consumers of Western and Israeli businesses. Economic boycott against the Zionist regime is not a new phenomenon. It hits the apartheid entity where it feels and hurts the most. It's one of the most significant weak spots of the Zionist regime occupying Palestine. While purely econometric reasons are certainly important, it is only one of the factors and not the factor. A significant number of Zionist colonizers in Palestine hold foreign citizenship. Figures vary from 10% according to the Dual Citizenship Report to 17% according to Times of Israel report of 2016 to 22% according to Israeli blogger Daniel Barabim. There is a speculation that the actual figures may be as high as 35% or even 50% of Israelis holding dual citizenship. They will not stick around in a hostile environment, which will become even more difficult as economic, political, and military pressure continues to increase on the Zionist regime. When a better option is easily available, away from war and economic ruin, not all, but many people will opt for the easier option, leave. Both the current Zionist mass murder campaign in Palestine and the regional assistance to Israel are unprecedented in nature and totally out of proportions. This applies to the economic and boycott angle of resistance against Israel and its Western enablers. What makes this current limited impact a longer-term strategic challenge to the Zionist regime and brands facing the grassroots boycott is that this time, due to the scale of events in the region, more people have joined and it is clearly having some impact. The phenomenon of limited impact creates a vicious perception cycle, which then translates into concrete negative monetary impact. As some brands can no longer conceal that the grassroots boycott is having an impact, more ordinary consumers are motivated by the fact that their objection to genocide in Palestine is working. This results in more people joining the boycott since they feel empowered. This phenomenon snowballs into a much bigger boycott movement. Those familiar with the politics of the so-called Muslim Street in West Asia and the Arab world know well that boycotting of brands closely associated with Western imperialist regimes has been around for decades. Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only weekly show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. After Michael Gove, the UK's Secretary of State for Levelling Up, announced the government's redefinition of extremism, we'll be examining the implications of his statement in this week's show. It seems Mr. Gove is attempting to invoke the divide-and-rule tactics of the former British Empire to weaken the pro-Palestine movement that's been sweeping the country since October the 7th, as Latifa Abu Chakra will explain in this report.
The British government has been grappling with the question of extremism for years now. It has failed even to define extremism in any clear fashion and has been struggling to fight back against an avalanche of criticism that its counter-extremism policies are Islamophobic. The genocide in Gaza has focused minds in the British elite because of the massive sympathy for the Palestinians visible on the streets. The desperate attempt to cast pro-Palestine protesters as genocidal is a desperate attempt to split the movement. The government is trying to reframe extremism in such a way that more radical supporters of Palestinian liberation are demonized, criminalized, and disavowed by the rest of the movement. The minister leading this is the toxic Michael Gove, the most pro-Zionist minister in the government. He has a history of involvement with Zionist lobby groups and, for example, was the first chairman of the neoconservative and Islamophobic think tank Policy Exchange. It's no coincidence that the new policy he is introducing was dreamt up by the Policy Exchange in a paper published in 2022. All of its main proposals were adopted by Lord William Shawcross in his review of Prevent, published in 2023. Shawcross is famously Islamophobic and was appointed as a senior fellow at the Policy Exchange in 2018, prior to being appointed to the Prevent review in 2021. Shawcross's recommendations were all accepted by the government, and thus the new policy has effectively been written by a leading Islamophobic think tank. Among the innovations are a new blacklisting agency in Gove's department and a change in the status of the Commission for Countering Extremism, which changes from being an advisory to an enforcement agency. But behind Policy Exchange are a shadowy group of foundations which provide cash for its work. Though they are secretive, we can reveal at least two. The first and most significant is the Charles Wolfson Charitable Trust, which donates almost every year and has given Policy Exchange more than £3 million between 2007 and 2022. The Wolfson family, which runs the trust, are the owners of the Next retail chain. The Wolfson family also funds Beit Lochem, which channels money to the occupation forces, and the Jerusalem Foundation, which is engaged in promoting illegal settlements in occupied East Jerusalem. Another source of funds is the Rosencrantz Foundation, which has given to the think tank for more than a decade, along with other Islamophobic causes. Its director, Robert Rosencrantz, was appointed a director of Policy Exchange in 2010. In other words, British government policy on extremism is captured by Policy Exchange, and Policy Exchange is in part a front for Zionist interests.
Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest contributor today is Dr. Eital Hajj. Dr. Leila is the director and senior caseworker at Prevent Watch, which is a community-led initiative that supports individuals affected by the Prevent programme. She's written extensively on Prevent and co-authored the People's Review of Prevent, which was an alternative to the widely boycotted official review of the Prevent policy. Welcome to the show. David, the Policy Exchange, they must be absolutely delighted, wouldn't they, with Michael Gove's statement. I mean, could have been written by them. I mean, what do you make of that think tank?
Well, I mean, more or less was written by them. I mean, Policy Exchange is the first think tank that I think I ever looked at back in the late noughties. And we looked at the way in which it was encouraging Islamophobia, and that was why we looked at it. And we discovered, one of the things we discovered was that amongst the people who funded it were these foundations, and the foundations were all named after individuals, and we tried to work out what they were, and it transpired that, you know, amongst the other things that they funded were these Israeli occupation forces, settlements in the West Bank, and we realised that what we were dealing with here was Zionist foundations. So it was Zionist foundations who were largely funding the policy exchange and other neocon think tanks, and that's what we have here. We have effectively Zionist interests using a think tank to talk to government, and then their views are then taken on by government by people who are appointed by government who come from the think tank itself, and then those views themselves are passed on to the minister who himself was a first chair of policy exchange. It's a completely self-referential and closed circle.
Well, Dr. Lyon, I mean, what's your view then of the 2022 policy exchange report?
So that report was called Delegitimizing Counterterrorism, and it essentially attacked every single Muslim organization or individual who had A, boycotted the Shawcross Review of Prevent, and B, who had signed up and endorsed and supported the People's Review of Prevent. It was essentially a way to divide the Muslim organisations from the non-Muslim organisations and individuals, because if you look at who boycotted the Shawcross report, it extended way beyond any of the Muslim organisations that had been highlighted in that report. But it also tried to then divide Muslim organisations against one another as well, because following that report, there was a tabloid splash of like four organisations that, you know, are seen as the main Islamist agitators. So it kind of further then subdivided some organisations from the main list. Sure. It didn't look at any of the non-Muslim organisations. It didn't look at the fact that the People's Review of Prevent had the foreword from the UN Special Rapporteur for protecting freedoms while countering terrorism. It didn't look at the fact that Professor Conor Gearty had written the second foreword. It didn't look at any of the NGOs, the mainstream NGOs, Amnesty's, the Runnymedes, who had also supported that report. So I think it was just a way to plagiarise the People's Review of Prevent, because 90% of that report from Policy Exchange just spoke about our report without actually tackling any of the issues, whilst just trying to smear these organisations. And the former Prime Minister, David Cameron, wrote a foreword to the Policy Exchange report saying that these people who are basically raising concerns about Prevent are enablers of terrorism.
Well, of course, Lord Shawcross, David, was in charge of the Charity Commission, wasn't he? I mean, you say a word or two, will you, about his role there, will you?
So he was appointed to the Charity Commission, and he appointed a number of other people to the Charity Commission who were, like him, Islamophobes, and had connections to Islamophobic organisations. And his role at the Charity Commission was to take on Muslim charities and to investigate them. Now, quite often, those Muslim charities were investigated after allegations were made about those charities, which had emanated from Israel, you know, unsurprisingly. And so you had an attack on a whole series of Muslim charities, actually, and, of course, not really virtually no Zionist charities, for example, were targeted. And what it's meant is that the whole Muslim charity sector lives in fear of the Charity Commission. And to try and be in a charity and be a Muslim and to have a Muslim charity is really very difficult now because of this British state onslaught on the Muslim charity sector. And, of course, then Shawcross goes on after that to be appointed to the Policy Exchange and then to be appointed by government to do the review of Prevent. So he's, you know, he's not in a position to do any significant serious review because, of course, he is party pre. He's all fundamentally conflicted.
Well, as I mentioned in the introduction there, Dr. Layla, I mean, you were part of that, you know, People's review of Prevent, which actually engaged, didn't it, in debate with the review of extremism that was conducted by Lord Shawcross. Just tell us a little bit, really, about what you found during that process.
Yeah, so the People's Review of Prevent was set up as an alternative to the Shawcross Review because once he was appointed and boycotted, we knew he wasn't going to take on any of the real issues and concerns that had been raised for well over a decade, nor was he going to look at people who had actually been impacted, referred to Prevent, etc. So the People's Review of Prevent took into consideration almost 600 cases of people who had actually been referred to Prevent, as well as all of the academic research that had come out previously on Prevent. And at the end of that, our three main conclusions was that Prevent doesn't actually work. It's not fit for purpose. It doesn't prevent terrorism. There's been zero evidence to suggest that. And in fact, all the evidence suggests that it actively doesn't work, especially when you look at convicted terrorists who have been known to prevent prior. You know, they weren't caught by Prevent to stop and therefore prevent terrorism. The second main conclusion was that it causes harm, particularly to Muslim families and children, traumatizing them. And the third main conclusion was that it is curtailing so many human rights, from freedom of expression to data privacy and data rights. So those were the three main conclusions, and none of those conclusions were picked up by government or engaged with at any point, not that we expected them to be, other than that policy exchange report that was then subsequently published about a month or so after.
Mm. David, we've mentioned the Wolfson family on this show on a number of previous occasions, haven't we? And I see that they are implicated in this process too, aren't they? So I wonder whether you could just outline what exactly then is their involvement in this particular issue.
So the Wolfson family have been making money in this country for decades and decades through the Great Universal Stores and now most recently through Next PLC. And they've made a reputation for philanthropy. So they have a number of different foundations associated with the family. There are four or five different foundations. They give large sums of money to Wolfson College, Oxford, or Wolfson College, Cambridge, and many other charitable donations. But, of course, also they give significant sums of money to Zionist projects, so to settlements in the West Bank, and particularly they fund the Jerusalem Foundation, which is engaged in illegal activities in East Jerusalem. And they also fund, and indeed the chair of this charity, Beit Halachim, is an organisation which gives money directly to the Israel occupation forces. Mm-hmm. So there's a real sense there in which they're involved directly in supporting the Zionist project and the genocide in Gaza. But also, of course, they're involved in supporting Islamophobic activities through the policy exchange. And Andrew Wilson, for example, or Simon Wilson are involved with that. And as a result, what you have is that you can see that the Zionists are actually core to developing and pushing Islamophobic ideas in the UK and in other countries too. And that's a thing I've been seeing for many years now. It's one of the things which attracted attention to my views when I was at the University of Bristol. But it's very clear that there's a connection between the Zionists and the pushing of Islamophobia, and you can see it through this particular connection between the Wolfson family and the cash they give to the policy exchange.
Mm. Michael Gove was the first chair, wasn't he, of the policy exchange? And as I was saying to David earlier, I mean, this report or this statement could have been written by them. I mean, what's your thoughts on that briefly before we go to our next report?
I mean, Michael Gove has been problematic for many reasons, not just the policy exchange link. I mean, he was at the centre of the Trojan Horse affair, effectively ruining education in the UK, and many other Islamophobic as well as anti-Palestinian sentiments have come from him. But I mean, his involvement in this, as well as Policy Exchange's involvement in the new so-called definition of extremism, is to be expected. Yeah. I don't think we can imagine anyone else who would have taken the reins on this, nor anybody who wanted to. I mean, the Independent Review of Terrorism doesn't have Prevent under his purview, nor extremism. Sure. You know, Sarah Khan, when she was appointed as head of CCE, everyone thought she was going to come out with a definition of extremism, and she didn't. Mm. Robin Simcox, who then took over CCE, didn't.
So it's significant then that it's Michael Gove. But it's important, I think, that we shine a light on his role, and you know, I think that will undermine his credibility still further, hopefully. But we'll just take a pause there now to our next report about the naked abuse of parliamentary privilege to stem the tidal wave of support for Palestine from the British people.
Let me just ask, in the interest of balance, is there anyone here who welcomes what Michael Gove had to say and supports what he had to say? Not a hand up, okay.
The British government is in a bind. It can't define extremism, and yet it wants to pretend that it can. It claims that its new policy contains a, quote, new definition of extremism. But there was never an old definition, and the text they've published is not a definition either. There is still no legal definition of extremism, and this is why the government are at pains to point out that this definition is not statutory and has no effect on the existing criminal law. The reason for this is that the government knows that if they try and create a statutory definition, it will be subject to legal challenge, which it will most probably lose. There's a nervousness about this, which is intriguing. First of all, Michael Gove named five extremist organizations under parliamentary privilege because he knows he would be subject to legal action were he to name them outside the House. Secondly, though the aim here is to destroy and disrupt the Palestine Solidarity Movement, No primarily Palestine-related groups were named. But pro-Palestine groups, Friends of Al-Aqsa, was named in drafts of the speech leaked to the media. The government were too nervous even to name them in parliament. Gove stated in the Commons that Islamism is a totalitarian ideology which calls for the establishment of an Islamic state governed by Sharia law. He named three groups, the Muslim Association of Britain, CAGE and MEND, all perfectly legal organizations. MEND immediately challenged Gove to, quote, repeat his claims outside of Parliament and without the protection of parliamentary privilege, to provide the evidence that MEND has called for the establishment of an Islamic state governed by Sharia law. Even normally staunch allies such as government advisor John Mann have criticized the policy. The division is between those pushing for a Likudnik scorched-earth approach and those who favor a sophisticated engagement strategy. This is not just a political and strategic difference, but a question of defending the millions in state and Zionist funding plowed into the maintenance of hundreds of jobs in sophisticated engagement, such as the interfaith industry. Underlying all of this is the danger that the definition best fits genocidal Zionist groups and their supporters within government, most notably Michael Gove himself. The penetration and capture of key elements of security policy by the Zionist is nothing if it is not, as the new so-called definition puts it, an attempt to undermine, overturn, or replace the UK system of liberal parliamentary democracy and democratic rights in the service of attempting to negate or destroy the fundamental rights and freedoms of others, most obviously Muslims and Palestinians and their supporters.
Dr. Layla, I mean, some people are suggesting that this is just an attempt to proscribe organisations by the back door. What do you think about that?
Absolutely agree with that, because if you look at from a legal perspective, there is nothing that these organisations are doing that is illegal that could be used in a way against them to shut them down. And this is one way, as I say, you know, this new definition of extremism, it's not statutory, but it doesn't mean that it won't have impact. This will have impact on the ground. Of course it will. If you look at charities, for example, who are trying to host events with these organisations, they may have to jump through extra hurdles via the Charity Commission in terms of, you know, if you're inviting an extremist speaker, and technically they will be on that list of extremist speakers without being able to, not being afforded to even challenge it legally because there is no legal basis. And it's exactly what we see with Prevent. You know, Prevent technically is voluntary. Doesn't mean that it hasn't caused harm to thousands of people across the UK.
I mean, we've already seen lots of people being cancelled. I mean, David and I are case in point, really. I guess this is just going to exacerbate that problem. But David, why do you think they're struggling so much then to define extremism then?
Well, because they start off with this idea that they're counteracting and countering terrorism. And, of course, that involves the commission of acts of violence, and which are, you know, identifiable as being against the law. And we have a burgeoning terrorism legislation on the statute books, and that's been expanding over the years since the first introduction of the Provincial Terrorism Act, temporary provisions, as it was called back in the 70s. And, of course, they've then moved to this idea of non-violent extremism, or of extremism which is of a sort which might not really be terrorism, but might be leading up to terrorism. But they can't really define that because, of course, these are actions which are not illegal, which are not violent, and which only arguably, in their own minds, have anything to do with the process of leading up to violence, the process of which they call radicalisation. And of course, we saw this in the case of the Irish conflict, where in the 1980s, Sinn Féin were banned from television.
Yeah.
So the idea of supporting an illegal organisation or an organisation named in this notice, Sinn Féin, was prescribed. But nobody could actually work out what supporting that organisation meant. And it was so ridiculous that the whole thing collapsed, partly as a result of the peace process too. So we'll find something similar here. If you have a definition, then when you try and work out what it actually means, it will just be absurd and will collapse. And that's why they've got this pretend definition, and also it's an attempt, as Dr. Layla has been saying, to intimidate. These are the reasons they can't define it.
Well, Dr. Layla, I mean, the earlier documents seem to suggest that Mr. Gove was considering naming a much wider group of organisations, including your own Prevent Watch and groups like Palestine Action and Friends of Al-Aqsa. I mean, what's going on here?
I mean, it's quite ridiculous. If you look at, for example, Prevent Watch, we are literally a helpline to support people who have had their rights abused. So we would never come under any definition, not that we would even respect any definition put forward for extremism in a way, because of the fact that the whole trajectory and the history of trying to define it has been nonsense,
indeed,
including this new one. But I do think it is just an attempt to intimidate and to place that idea that, you know, if you support these organisations, then there may be a problem. If you look at actually the shift from the old so-called definition of extremism to this new one, it's shifted from being very individual-based, so looking at individuals who might be extremist, to the infrastructure that supports the Muslim community. So we're now looking at institutions. And there was a report published a few years back, I can't remember which report it was, but the sole purpose of that report was to look at all of these organisations and look at their social media influence. And so if you look at some of the organisations that have made the list, those organisations have a huge impact when it comes to their social media reach. And it was by one of these right-wing think tanks, this report that was conducted. And I'm sure it has influenced, you know, how many organisations are being put up, whether they're officially named or whether it's like, oh, we might leak these organisations. Oh, no, we won't.
No,
I mean, they've already leaked it. The damage has been done potentially. Yeah.
Well, David, excuse me, David, what's your view of the three organisations, Muslim organisations, that that were named? You know, the Muslim Association of Britain, CAGE and MEND, I mean, mentioned in the report there. I mean, perfectly respectable organisations. Just say a bit, what's your view of those organisations?
Well, I mean, the Muslim Association of Britain is an interesting organisation. It's said by Gove to be the British affiliate of the Muslim Brotherhood. Supposed to put scary quotes around it. But the Muslim Association of Britain, of course, was one of the three organisations which set up the Stop the War Coalition after the invasion, in the run-up to and after the invasion of Iraq, and was core to the success of the anti-war movement, which had 2 million people on the streets in 2003. And, of course, the reason it was core to it was because it was a Muslim organisation, and that was the essential success. And that is what scared the horses in Whitehall. Muslims are getting politically active. And you see the same thing with the almost inclusion of Friends of Al-Aqsa. Friends of Al-Aqsa, of course, one of the key organisers of the massive pro-Palestine demonstrations have been since October the 7th, along with Palestine Solidarity to Stop the War. So, again, this is an attempt to take out part of the key coalition which brings together this massive wave of support for Palestine and against British foreign policy, complicity and direct engagement of the British in the genocide. So that's one thing, right? And the second thing is, of course, the other organisations. CAGE is a human rights organisation. Dr. Lely used to work there. And I've written on a number of occasions about CAGE should not be attacked. They're a human rights organisation, and it's absurd to accuse them of extremism. And then MEND, I mean, MEND are milder than CAGE are. It's completely absurd to say. I mean, the idea that MEND is an organisation which calls for a caliphate, which would itself, in my view, be completely fine, because the caliphate is not any particular thing. It's a system of government in which Muslim ideas might be reflected, just like Christian ideas are reflected or Hindu ideas are reflected in some other systems of government. So this is a nonsense from start to finish. And, of course, the reason why they can't name these organisations outside is because they're going to be taken to court and they're going to lose.
Indeed. Well, just briefly then, because we're almost out of time, Dr. Layla, what should we then make of Mr. Gove's new policy? Briefly.
I think absolutely nothing of it, other than another dog whistle politics attempt to intimidate people, not only to not support individuals who might have ideas that are very conservatively Muslim, but also to try and attack the infrastructure that helps these Muslims to participate in public life.
Indeed. And probably we should be ridiculing it whenever we get the opportunity. It is so absurd, isn't it? But thank you to our guest, Dr. Layla Eytal-Hajj, and our resident expert, Professor David Miller. So until next time, when Palestine Declassified will be back with more forensic investigations and analysis, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
in the limelight.
Peter Navarro, who served as White House trade advisor to former President Donald Trump, has turned himself into a federal prison in Miami, Florida. The U.S. Supreme Court has rejected Navarro's last-ditch request to avoid prison. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Peter Navarro, who served as White House trade advisor to former President Donald Trump, turned himself in to a federal prison in Miami, Florida on Tuesday, 19th of March, to begin serving a four-month sentence for defying a congressional subpoena. His surrender came just one day after Chief Justice John Roberts rejected his 11th-hour bid to remain free while he appeals his conviction for contempt of Congress. Peter Navarro was assigned to an 80-person dormitory reserved for older inmates in the Miami facility, according to a source familiar with the matter, where he's expected to have some access to email and phone. At a press conference at a strip mall across the street from the prison before turning himself in, Peter Navarro claimed his case represents an unprecedented assault on the separation of powers and executive privilege. When I walk in that prison today, the justice system, such as it is, will have done a crippling blow to the constitutional separation of powers and executive privilege, he told a group of reporters. Navarro pledged to appeal his conviction to the U.S. Supreme Court and claimed his conviction stemmed from the actions of lawmakers, prosecutors and judges who are Trump haters. There is no evidence that his prosecution was politically motivated. This is the partisan weaponization of our judicial system, Navarro said, taking issue with a ruling that barred him from presenting certain defenses to the jury that is now one of the subjects of his appeal. He's the first former White House official to go to prison after being convicted of contempt of Congress. Peter Navarro was charged and found guilty after he refused to comply with a subpoena from the House Select Committee that investigated the 6th of January 2021 attack on the Capitol. Congressional investigators were seeking documents and testimony from the former White House official tied to his post-2020 election conduct and efforts to delay the certification of Electoral College votes. He was sentenced to 4 months in prison in January. He appealed both his conviction and the trial judge's decision to enforce his sentence as the appeal is further litigated. Navarro has long held that he thought he was bound by executive privilege when he refused to comply with the committee's demands, but the judge overseeing his case ruled there was no evidence that the privilege was actually invoked. Peter Navarro has been ordered to turn himself into federal prison in Miami, Florida by Tuesday, 19th of March. A three-judge panel on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals already rejected his bid to delay the sentence, writing he was unlikely to secure a new trial or reverse his conviction. In urging the Supreme Court to grant him emergency relief and put a hold on his surrender, Peter Navarro's lawyers argued that he is neither a flight risk nor a threat to public safety, and therefore should be allowed to remain free whilst he pursues his appeal. Dr. Navarro is the only former senior presidential advisor to be prosecuted for contempt of Congress following an assertion of executive privilege by the president that that advisor served, his attorneys wrote in their request to the court. They told the justices that Navarro's prosecution for contempt of Congress violated the separation of powers doctrine, so his